Today, the history of men's only clubs and why they still exist in 2020. If we were to travel back in time to the late 19th century, in the heart of central London was an area called Clubland. It was home to a collection of exclusive men-only clubs, sanctuaries for the modern gentleman who wanted to spend his leisure time among like-minded men of good standing.
The purpose of the clubs in the 19th century, and I think this is continued today, was to be amongst your peers in a comfortable space. They always talk about the club being a society of equals. And you could talk about things knowing they ascribe to the same values and ideas that you did. You're never going to be probably confronted there by something uncomfortable.
One of the things that made some men of that era uncomfortable was the presence of women. Though over time, that changed. Gradually, some clubs began to accept female members. But not all of them. Over the years, the illustrious men's only Garrick Club has included in its ranks writers like H.G. Wells, actors like Stephen Fry and Laurence Olivier, and journalists like Melvyn Bragg. Members enjoy access to a massive collection of theatrical paintings and drawings, an extensive library with rare manuscripts, and an imposing dining room where they can enjoy roast beef and fine wine. But their long-standing tradition of gender exclusivity is now being contested.
Lingerie tycoon Emily Bendel is taking legal action against London's Garrick Club in a bid to force them to allow women to become members.
She argues its men-only rule, which has been in place for 189 years, is discriminatory and unlawful.
The club has until October 5th to reply to her legal challenge.
You know, obviously I've been accused, you've probably seen as, you know, it's a publicity stunt. You know, it's not fun. You know, this is not an enjoyable process. You know, it's quite, you know, I think anyone that thinks it is, try living it. It's not.
From The Guardian, I'm Mythili Rao. Today in Focus, should men-only private members' clubs still exist? Emily, you're a businesswoman, you run a successful lingerie company, and it's actually quite unusual to have a woman running a company that makes women's underwear. Victoria's Secret, Calvin Klein, Agent Provocateur, for example, they all have men at the top of their companies. How did you end up where you are? Was running a business something you always wanted to do from childhood?
I was very entrepreneurial. I had a number of different sort of rackets on the go at school, some more successful than others.
What were those?
Oh, all sorts of different things. I mean, my aunt had a stall at Camden Market. So I used to kind of take orders for things that were on sale in Camden and then sell them at school. That one was quite successful, actually. I ended up with a rep at another school. I think I had an illegal tuck shop under my desk at one point that got shut down.
That's great.
My grandparents had a market store, then a shop, actually, in East London. So I suppose I came from that stock, but it wasn't something that was front of mind. And actually, it wasn't I was looking to start a business. It was more that I saw the lingerie industry at the time had a kettish male gaze, submissive, didn't speak to me, found it very troubling. And to me, lingerie was something completely different to that. It was a sort of a personal fashion purchase, something that you enjoy. And I couldn't find that, so I wanted to create that.
And growing up, how did you see traditional gender roles?
I don't recall sort of ever feeling growing up that my opportunities were sort of different. You know, I had a very sort of liberal upbringing. When I was sort of university age, studied politics, philosophy, economics at Oxford, and I started to kind of notice the nuances and differences and the challenges that come with being female. I mean, I think, you know, one of the first sort of times I really sort of felt it, I remember I was sort of running for student president when I was at college, and I really noticed the difference between the way I had to act compared to the men that were running against me.
How did you have to act that was different from how the men had to act?
There could be comedy in their pitches, jokes, you know, but actually I felt that from, you know, as a woman, you had to sort of be more serious, to be taken seriously. You know, there were sort of these nuances at play. And then obviously as I started the business, and particularly raising investment for the business, was when I sort of noticed more and more things that were perhaps challenging.
We've done some research on you, and we know you won those student elections. So
I did.
it seems like what you did worked, but did it feel uncomfortable?
I didn't feel it was a completely level playing field, that there was still these sort of core differences. And then as I got older, you know, certainly starting the business and going to events where you're one of a handful of women in the room, my first sort of experience of the challenge there is that the first step typically for raising a sort of relatively small round is business angels, you know, individuals that invest. And I went out, you know, booked a pitch to a number of these sort of, you know, it's like a Dragon's Den style events where you sort of pitch. And it was just a sea of male faces. But the problem with having such a homogeneous group of people investing is obviously you then end up with businesses that are outside their sphere of experience, struggling to raise finance. You know, at the very extreme of it, I did also have some real kind of schoolboy type questions.
What kind of questions?
Questions that are not a genuine question, questions that are asked to get a laugh. And so I found it a real challenge. It was quite disheartening. I wasn't finding people who understood the business that were willing to invest. I ended up putting on my own event. I cold called high net worth women to come to that event. And it was through that I met an all-female angel network that had just been established.
So all these years later, you've launched a business selling a product for women, thanks to the support of women's investors. But now you're in the headlines for trying to join an all-men's club, the 189-year-old Garrick Club here in London. When did you first become interested in the Garrick?
Sort of tail end of last year, I was looking at members' clubs, speaking to friends and so on, came across the Garrick. And I just couldn't believe in 2020 that was still the case. I was really surprised and shocked. And then when I obviously looked at who the membership was, who was going there, I was even more surprised.
Why were you looking at members' clubs in the first place?
I mean, my offices are quite far East London, so I was looking for sort of a more central base for meetings and so on. It's not always possible to persuade people to come as far east as where we are.
And the Garrick Club in particular, when did you think that you wanted to be a member of this club? I mean, apparently the average age of members is 70. What was it about this club that you were like, I want to be a part of it?
This is not about my personal profile in the Garrick. You know, for me, this is about principle. You know, do I particularly want to be a member of the club made up of whatever percentage of people that don't believe women should be allowed to be members? One doesn't choose to, you know, be in that kind of environment. There's a lot of reasons, which I understand, that people have said, well, hang on, you're an entrepreneur. This is a club that typically attracts the legal profession or those in politics or in the arts. It's not about that. And if the Garrick wanted to turn me down based on my profile, then that's completely understandable. Turning me down based on my gender is not. I'd sort of been a little bit disheartened by the focus on me as an individual and the club, because it entirely misses the point. You know, Stephen Fry famously put forward Joanna Lumley, who could not be a better fit for that club, and Joanna Lumley was turned down. And a number of, you know, female QCs have spoken out, from Baroness Hale to Diana Rose QC, about their dismay at the male-only policy. So I kind of want to move the conversation away from my personal fit with the club, because that's really not the point here.
So it's about the principle. It's about, why is this club not allowing women?
Absolutely.
We've talked about, you know, all women's spaces, the ways in which they can be beneficial. What's the difference in your mind between a men-only space and a women's-only space?
It's not necessarily about men and women. I think it's about what is the purpose. So, for example, there is a men's nursing association, which I think any reasonable person would understand the necessity for the existence of that. I think people would probably object to a women's nursing association excluding male nurses, because women are very overrepresented compared to men in that profession. The moral case is we have to ask ourselves, well, what is the reason for exclusion based on gender? Women's networks generally have been created in response to women's underrepresentation. And so, you know, for me, you say, okay, what's the purpose of the Garrick Club? And originally it was founded to sort of bring together people in the art. So what is the reason to exclude women from that? When women, you know, at the time it was founded, obviously women were excluded from professions. So there weren't any women professional in the arts, but now there are.
you're a historian, and I noticed on your website that one of your primary academic interests is men's mental illness in Victorian culture. Another is Jack the Ripper. So I'm wondering, how did these interests lead you into studying British men's clubs?
Well, it was a bit of the other way around. So I started studying men's clubs during my PhD for my dissertation.
Amy Milne-Smith is an associate professor of history at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario, Canada.
It was in reading club stories that I actually came across instances of mental illness that I thought were fascinating and had to put aside to read for later, these eccentric clubmen kind of breaking down in very public ways.
Your book is called London Clubland. Where in London was Clubland, and what is that corner of the city like?
Clubland, which sometimes was actually marked on maps as such in the 19th century, was St. James and Pall Mall. You see echoes of that today a little bit, those buildings on those streets that don't have any names on them and don't have an address of what they are. Those are the clubs whose windows are slightly above eye level so you can't see in. But in the 19th century in particular, almost every building on that street was a club.
Your work uses the term clubbable. Is that meaning that you're white, wealthy, and male? Or are there other characteristics that make a person clubbable?
Well, white, wealthy, and male was step one to being clubbable. But it is this kind of fantastic, ineffable term that they came up with to describe the right sort of fellow. I mean, the great thing about exclusivity is you define it how you want. And that's kind of the purpose. It should be a little mercurial. So they would define a clubbable man as someone they would want to spend an evening with. But of course, who we want to spend an evening with is different from person to person.
How would you determine which club you would join if you were a young man of some means looking to socialize?
Well, the clubs each did have their own character. So sometimes the club would be determined by your family. So, for example, White's Club, the most aristocratic, exclusive club in London, fathers would put their sons on the waiting list when they were born. But there also were clubs that catered to particular interests. So you had the Athenaeum, that was the home of the arts. You had the political clubs. You had the Army and Navy clubs. You had East India Club for those who perhaps had foreign travel in their background.
And what about the Garrick Club in particular? What's its origin story? What kind of people were drawn to it?
Well, the Garrick Club at its foundation was a bit of, you could say, an outlier. It was not in Clubland, for example, right off the bat. They decided to set up closer to the theaters from its very beginning. We're saying, well, we're a little bit more for artists and for theater people, and we don't want to be stuffy like those other clubs. It was founded in about 1831, and this was part of the new wave of 19th century clubs that were emerging. And it had a lot of famous theater people with them who, of course, would have wanted a more bohemian, perhaps slightly more raucous club experience than, you know, some of the old St. James clubs that was once described as going to the Duke's house with the dead Duke lying upstairs. You know, very...
Ah, lovely.
Yes, very sedate, some of these clubs. I mean, it was founded in the honor of David Garrick, of course, hence the name. You know, they had a lot of famous people at the time. Charles Dickens and Thackeray and Trollope were all members. And they had painters like Rossetti and Millais as well.
I was surprised to learn that A.A. Milne played such a big part in the club's history. What was his role?
He was, like many, a devoted clubman. He loved his club, and he bequeathed them, I think, a quarter of the royalties from his children's books.
Wow.
Because a lot of these old clubs died out around or after the First World War. And with that legacy and the fact that everyone still loves Winnie the Pooh, they've been able to have incredible financial stability.
I contacted the Garrick Club to try to set up a tour. They asked me to email a woman who works at the front office. So obviously women do work at these men-only clubs now. Has that always been the case? And what is their role?
Women are relatively new to club land. In the 19th century, you wouldn't have seen women in the clubs working there, but it was male servants who were in control of managing the club, and so men would have only seen other men. It's a 20th century development where you start to see women being hired first as waitresses, basically. So they would start bringing food, which, much to the consternation of the older men, they were just so apoplectic about the fact that you would see a woman delivering your sherry to you. Just, it's the end of the world. But of course, they got used to it. And eventually, women started to get quite a few roles. I've noticed when I was contacting clubs to do research, several of the librarians of the club archives were women. People who are in staff positions are women.
It's interesting that in the 20th century, men became comfortable with the idea of women serving them at these clubs and being in the clubs, but that didn't begin to lead to actually opening the clubs up to women to attend.
I think you could say for the 18th century and the early 19th century, there weren't too many challenges. But when it comes to the 19th century, there absolutely was movement afoot to broaden some of these all-male spaces. And it came from both women, but actually from men as well.
Okay, but that movement never quite reached the Garrick Club. Here we are in 2020, and there's still no female members allowed at the Garrick. People who defend this club and clubs like it say it's a place to relax, to drink, to socialize with other men, not necessarily to network. Do you think that's true?
Not being a member, I wouldn't know, of course. Probably in its purpose, absolutely. I don't think men perhaps go there seeking out, oh, I'm going to make this business deal, I'm going to sign this new client. Except, where do you draw the line between business and pleasure? When you're talking politics with someone who has influential friends in politics, is that strictly social? If you are a group of high-powered lawyers having a conversation that is relevant to your work and to your interests, is that not work-related? I think that it's naive to say that these lines aren't blurred all the time.
These clubs seem to be not only surviving, but in some cases, thriving. I mean, there are long waiting lists to join some of these clubs. I can see why it might be practical to have had a club membership in the 19th century, but what's the appeal of a gentleman's club in 2020? I mean, why not just meet up at a restaurant? Is this just about nostalgia or a certain kind of power and privilege?
I find it fascinating that they've had this resurgence because there was a real fear from about the 50s to the 80s that clubland was just going to disappear. It's frankly one of the reasons they started allowing women members is that many of the clubs were in financial straits. And the uptick of popularity of clubs now, I think, is a peculiar phenomenon because it absolutely is not the same reason. I'm not a sociologist, but I would wonder if it's the escapism and the nostalgia that is driving that. You have to ask a club man. Sometimes it's members you might expect. I don't know, but I would assume that Jacob Rees-Mogg is a club man.
Just a hunch.
Just a hunch would be our stereotypical club man. But you will find members of, you know, the Garrick that you would think are quite modern and progressive and have nothing to do with the aristocracy.
Some of the elements of this debate around gentlemen's clubs reminds me of the debate that we've been having recently about colonial statues, that they're old, they're outmoded, but they're part of the national history. They're part of British culture. What's the harm in just letting them carry on as they always have and letting them continue to be part of the national landscape? I mean, is there a harm in letting these clubs continue as they always have?
Are these gentlemen's clubs sites of elitism and male power and privilege? I think it's hard to deny they aren't. But it's also true that if you allow women, they are right that it will change the character of the club. They will be losing something that they like. The question is, should they lose that? Should they ever have had this power and exclusivity to begin with? Where do you draw the line? Where can single-sex spaces exist? Where are they exclusive and where are they excluding?
Coming up, what would it look like for the Garrick Club to modernize? Emily, when you brought your legal challenge against the Garrick, it wasn't the first time that the issue of allowing women to be members had come up for the club. In 2015, the Garrick actually had a vote on that question, and almost half their membership voted against allowing women to join. I imagine they would point to the Equality Act of 2010, which does allow single-sex organizations to exist. So why do you think what the Garrick Club is doing is illegal?
The legal argument is that it's not illegal to have same-sex organisations. And obviously there are numerous single-race, single-sex organisations with really important and valuable purpose. What is illegal is to deny services based on race or gender or, you know, any other sort of inequality. So the Garrick has restaurants, has bars. Women are not allowed. They have to be bought drinks. They are given menus without the price on for their male counterpart to buy them food from. So it is that providing services, excluding women, that is the legal point.
And, you know, these sorts of clubs aren't just exclusive in terms of gender. They're also very expensive to join and quite racially homogenous. My colleague Amelia Gentleman wrote a Guardian long read in 2015 about the Garrick during that vote, and she snapped a picture of some of the members lining up to enter. As far as I can tell, they are all white. Is gender exclusivity really the biggest problem with these clubs?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure there are broader issues. You know, the Garrick, you have to know someone to get in, so that it's sort of a self-fulfilling, homogeneous sort of membership. You're right that non-whites are underrepresented there, but there is no rule such that only white people can apply for membership. If it was only white people can apply for membership at the Garrick, there would be an uproar about that, and that is not the case. But somehow culturally, we accept that gender is okay to exclude based around. That's culturally acceptable in a way that race or disability or sexuality probably wouldn't be. And I've been giving that a lot of thought over the last week, because it's kind of a strange, this sort of idea that actually on both sides, meant by men and women, that, well, actually we want to be in groups of our own sex. So it's kind of okay to have this men's only club, leave them to it. I think, you know, I'm still thinking about it really, but I think it's to do with this quite binary idea around male and female characteristics. You know, men are like this with certain characteristics, women are like this with certain characteristics, and men want to be around other men that feel like that.
It seems to me what makes some place like the Garrick Club so alluring isn't just that it's a men's space, but it's the power of that space, it's the wealth of that space, it's the grandeur of that space. But all these things are still built around keeping people out and keeping certain categories of people out. It might not be as obvious as a rule saying no women allowed, but these are spaces that exist to exclude certain people, right? Because they're exclusive members-only clubs. Don't we need to just get around that altogether and just sort of abolish these clubs?
Members' clubs can be a professional meeting space, so you've got somewhere to take people at a certain location that's useful. So that's, I think most people would agree, is sort of inoffensive. It's a sort of business requirement. What you're talking about, of course, is these invisible connections that these members' clubs create. So by clubbing people together that help each other out, that help promote each other, and denying access, whether officially or subtly, to that space, we're self-propagating the same homogeneous people coming through. The thing I found interesting about this whole experience, the argument has been dismissed in a number of publications with sort of headlines around the idea of, oh, there are a load of old todgers, I'm quoting here, a load of old todgers, leave them to it. You know, why does it matter? It's quite nice to be paid for. We've got our own elite now. It's really worried me, if I'm honest, because, you know, first of all, it's really misleading to write this off as sort of, oh, they're all a load of old todgers that are retired. They don't have any bearing on anything anymore. You know, leave them to it.
Just let them have their nice club.
Yeah, someone described it as an old people's home with wine, I think, was one description of the club. And but, you know, these are members of the current government. You know, these are active judges and QCs. It is completely untrue and misleading to suggest these are people who are not important. So, you know, is it okay that someone like Michael Gove wants to spend time in an environment where a woman doesn't get to see the price on a menu, where she can't buy her own drink? I don't find that okay.
That's all for today. My thanks to Emily Bendel and Amy Milne-Smith. This episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh, sound design by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back on Monday.